Good morning, everyone. Welcome to More Food for Thought, a program about food that's a companion show to Food Conversations, which is also focused on food, and in particular, the development of food sovereignty in the Shuswap. Today, you're listening, of course, as always, on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the food of the Shuswap. And I'm your host today. The normal host for More Food for Thought is Steve Corey, but he's on the producer's chair with the fingers on all the sliders, and I'm here as your host. And today we have three really important guests in terms of food in the Shuswap. First of all, the person I'm going to introduce first is Brad DeMille, because he is the co-owner of DeMille's Farm Market. Everybody's got a special name, and that's the special name of Brad's operation. We also have today two representatives of another food, important food entity in this community. We have David Askew, the president and owner of Askew's Foods, and we have Dave Wallace, operations manager for three of the Askew food stores. Welcome, all of you gentlemen.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Nice to
morning,
see you.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks, Warren.
You should all know, listeners, that we're conducting these interviews through the magic of distant communications. Everybody's in on Zoom, and so the studio, which is following all the usual COVID-19 rules and regulations, is a pristine site, and everybody's sitting in their own home with a cup of tea or a glass of water or a bottle of whiskey. But I think it's mostly the first. Anyway, let's get right into this show. We're going to doing two shows with these three really knowledgeable guests, but today's show is going to focus around origins. How did people get into the food world, and why, you know, what was that trajectory? Because everybody's got a different story. Everyone's got a way of getting to where they are today, and it's not always a straightforward way. I'm going to start with David, because you might say the granddaddy of them all when it comes to being involved in the food business in Salmon Arm. I was doing a little historical research before the show, and your grandfather, Richard Dick Askew, trained as a butcher in Lancashire in England, and then came to Canada when he was 21 years of age. Do you remember your first remembrance and memories of your grandfather, Dick Askew?
Well, Dick Askew, you know, who's my father's father, he actually, as you say, he came out to Canada first in 1913. And I have only small recollections of him, the smell of his pipe, because he died when I was about 5 years old. Mm-hmm. So really, I only saw him sitting in his chair when he was, you know, when he was ill. So I didn't, you know, have a lot. Mostly what I know about him is from what I've been told.
Well, I've looked up a lot of information about the historical origins of Askew's. And when his partner, the Palmer clan, and the Askew clan were initially involved together,
Dick was hired to manage the Palmer
indeed
store.
He was. And obviously his competency and his skill ended up causing him to become the principal as the Palmer family fortunes declined somewhat. But it's interesting that when, in 1888, there were 24 people living in Salmon Arm from the settler community, which I think merits a mention of the fact that there had been people living here for thousands of years to whom these interlopers must have looked like a strange breed from far away. The indigenous community here, we are, of course, on unceded territory of the Interior Salish, and especially the Shuswap Nation. And these people came into that world bringing a whole new kind of way of looking at the world. So your grandfather, in fairly short order, in about 10, 15 years, became a principal in the business. His skills as a butcher were quite renowned. I saw a picture of your grandfather, and I think it was your dad, but it could have been somebody else in the family. There's a very large family of Askews with their famous bacon. Their famous bacon became the Curo Sweet hams and bacon. What can you tell us about Curo Sweet, David?
Well, yeah, my grandfather was very proud of his hams and bacon, and he used to take them down to the BC Locker Association every year, and I still have the plaques of first prize, second prize, and so on for hams and bacon. And actually, later on, and I came back to work for the company for a year in 1974, and I did the curing of the hams and bacon for a year, and I really enjoyed that part of the work, and people gave us a lot of praise for our product.
So are you going to reveal the secret of Curo Sweet ham and bacon on the radio?
Oh yes,
today?
I still have the recipe, and the secret ingredient was demerara sugar. That was the sweet part.
Well, I've always liked demerara sugar. I would have done well at that time. Now, Dave Wallace, you're the operations manager for Askews, and you came into Askews in over time. Your father had a pig farm, a hog farm, quite a substantial one, in Armstrong. That's where you grew up. Oh, you came originally, I believe, from Hazleton. Then you moved here when you were young. What was that like? Did you see in the food scene that there were different players? At that time, Askews was obviously developed in the community. You got involved with it.
Yeah, actually, the year we moved to Armstrong, and David could probably clarify, was 74, 75, and I think that's right when the Askews opened up, if I'm correct, in Armstrong. And that's when we started our quite a long, large hog operation. I was only 7, 8 years old at the time. But I do recall the food scene being that, yes, you went down to the grocery store for your staples, but on a much larger scale, you got your chickens from a neighboring farm, your asparagus, your strawberries, your half side of lamb. I quite remember well, my dad would trade a half side of pork for a half side of lamb from the guy down the road. And it was just the way things were done back then. And so it wasn't until 83 when I started at Askews, when I was 14 or 15 years old. But I quite enjoyed growing up in the farming community in Armstrong Spalanchine.
Now, Brad, you have a different story. You eloped from the United States with your family when you were a young fella. Tell us what that was like. You came from California. You left California and you came to Canada. As a child, what do you remember of that experience of coming to this part of the world from that part of the world?
Well, good morning, and thanks for having me. What's interesting about the leaving California is that as young kids, I was 8, I think, just about, or right around that area. We had my dad had come over to this valley with my grandpa and came across the top of Tank Hill and probably saw this magical place that had opportunity. That's the way I remember it. Then they came back. The dollar was about, I think it was 20 cents, the advantage for Canadian dollar. It was crazy, completely backwards. For
bad timing, huh?
Well, I think the acreage cost was pretty low at the time compared to what it is now, and it should be. I remember being like one of the Beverly Hillbillies, putting everything we owned in a 5-cent truck, and my grandma was driving it, I think, and we had left California, and seriously, I don't know why they let us in. We looked like this is
stragglers.
Not,
you look right. Like stragglers.
And we came into this valley. We fell into the old Donnelly farm on 50th, which is now the DeMay Dairy Farm. We went into this house and we walked in, and the pipe had broken, and our whole house was flooded. This is our welcoming in. After a long drive with the Clampets from California, and this is the way it started, not really on a positive note, but we were able to get it dried out, I believe, and we moved on. And the farm was not like it is today, of course. Pretty modern dairy farms they have these days.
Yeah. And your grandfather came a year later.
Yes, he ended up buying what is now the Gortz farm. We had initially been, it was used to be the Christensen sheep farm, actually, and Christian Road, of course, named by it. And we bought that, I think it was about a 40 or 50 acre parcel at the time. And Grandpa started, he was very, very able to do things. He started off as a barber in Anaheim and became somewhat a pseudo carpenter, more a California carpenter, because it took a while for him to understand snow load, and things like those things. So.
He also, you, in your farm, which was a dairy farm, you also grew sweet corn. Now, my own father-in-law was a dairy farmer in the Lower Mainland, and he grew corn, but it was all for the cows. But you guys were growing corn for humans right off the bat.
Well, before we left California, I remember my dad used to grow watermelons and dabble in a little bit of corn and things like that. When we moved to Canada in 1970, it was sweet corn was really, really novel. It was cow feed. And the early varieties like Early V and Bantam were, like, by today's comparison, we wouldn't eat them. Starchy, little, not very good, honestly. But we started off with 10 rows, and they started off a little side stand, selling, just get some money and get some cash in hand. And it proved to be, well, obviously with lots of work like David and Askew's has done, it takes a while, a long time to stick, sort of thing.
Absolutely. David, your family business went through many different kind of modifications, stores in Vernon, stores in Kamloops, stores in various places. What do you think brought it to coalesce in Salmon Arm?
Well, I think my grandfather, as I mentioned, he came out from England in 1913. At that time, the train stopped in Salmon Arm, and he must have got out on the platform and looked around and thought, this is the place, you know, I'd like to come back to and settle. And so he ended up going back and fighting in World War I, coming back with my grandmother. And he had a little homestead up in Kamloops. And it's quite interesting because just a couple of years ago, I saw some letters. He had actually made it back there during the war when he was on furlough. And he wrote to his girlfriend in England, Mary, and said he was putting up hay and trying to build up money for their wedding. And Mary, would you let me know? Would you confirm that you want to marry me? And a year later, he was back there again, and he wrote another letter saying, Mary, I haven't heard from you since my last letter. But anyway,
darn it.
Eventually, it did come to pass. And so they came out to the homestead, and my grandmother took one look at it and said, we're not living here. And so that's when he went looking for a job and found the job with the family butcher shop in Salmon Arm. So that's how they came to actually come to Salmon Arm.
Anybody who has the notion listening to this show that people's lives go in a straight line, you can abandon that notion right now. You're hearing how real lives go. So just a few more remarks from you, David. When I was reading the historical record from the Historical Society here, they said that your grandfather was remembered as resilient, hardworking, optimistic, and prone to big dreams. Do you think this kind of sort of imaginative way of looking at things has been part of the sort of Askew's approach to thing in the business?
Well, he had a big family, as you mentioned earlier, four boys and four girls, and they all got involved in the business. And I guess partly that was part of his design, was to have family members who could work in the business. And they were a rather disputatious lot as time went on. So there were a lot of things to be settled out. My grandfather had stores here and there in Vernon. I actually spent 3 years in Vernon. My father ran the store there. I don't think my grandfather, he had big dreams. I'm not sure about his business acumen, because he was operating out of a shared space there, and the grocer owned the space, and after a couple of years booted Askew's out. So that's how he ended up closing the store in Vernon. But my father had, Lloyd had big dreams, and he was a hard worker. And as time went on and the supermarket started to take over the store that we had on Alexander, where Alex is now, he could see that without the parking, he was going to lose out to the supermarket. So he started to look for an opportunity to build his own supermarket. That was the big gamble that really got Askew's, you know, got Askew's going.
Was that when you moved to Lakeshore?
Yes.
Yeah, 1967, I understand that.
That's right.
Yeah. Dave, you came to a hog farm with your family, but you were young, you were a kid. What was it like living on a big acreage, being able to sort of do what you want? Lots of space.
It was incredible, actually. You know, we had we did the whole farm thing right from the get-go. We milked our own goats for the milk, and I had five siblings. We all had our own horses. We had a traditional Santa cutter sleigh in the winter time that we would actually, like I think I mentioned to you, you'd head down to the dairy farm down the road in the cutter and you'd load up some fresh milk out of their stainless steel vat and mark on the calendar how much you took. And we actually, at 8 or 9 years old, as I'm sure Brad and David can attest to, you couldn't wait till you were allowed to drive the tractor and go disc a couple acres of field. You felt like quite the farmer yourself. So many great memories.
One thing about having access to private property with a vehicle, you can go a little nuts, which is a lot of fun. Brad, you came up and you came to this new world. You were young at that time. You were 8 years old. What was it like moving to a farm in the shoe swap as a kid? What was that like for you?
Well, I think we collectively thought our parents had gone completely the wrong direction. Never go north. We thought, well, we're leaving this cool place, California, for this. And then, of course, with the flooded house and walking into this place with completely overgrown with trees, we were like, as young, impressionable children, and 8, and my sisters were 9 and 11. My youngest brother was 6. It was nuts. But you know, once we started to realize that how much freedom we had and how fun the seasons were, especially the snow, we didn't really understand cold, and we'd go out in the morning and never come back till the rest of the day evaporated. And they never came looking for us. I think that's probably why they had 4 kids.
thought they'd lost a few.
We could, but it was fantastic as a young kid, just like Dave's experience, just your freedom to go on properties that weren't necessarily yours or marked, and who really was that uptight about it then, really. We used to go up Christian Road to the Fly Hills and do our, whether it's on a bicycle or go down to Silver Creek by Swibbs Bridge and bike there over the course of the day and come back at the end of the day and play in the river with the salmon when there were salmon. So there's lots of those fun memories. I remember catching one. It was about 18 pounds. I think it was huge. And honestly, I've not seen a fish that big in that river since.
Well, unfortunately, the river's taken a hit thanks to some engineers dumping a lot of rock in the Fraser River when the early sockeye run, which is the Salmon River run, was just coming up and pretty much wiped it out in one shot. That's unfortunately why the salmon are not as plentiful as they used to be. So what I'm getting a picture about is a more informal world, a world where relationships between people were much more visible. Everybody kind of knew everybody else. There was trust among citizens. You knew who your neighbors were. I guess they couldn't get away with much because you knew who they were and knew what they were doing. But you also interacted with people in your region. And that involved the food world as well. But as time went by, there has been some major changes. Brad, you told me that there was a time when the farm just took a giant hit. Tell everybody about that. And you also mentioned that, Dave, that there was the bottom dropped out of markets from time to time. So, Brad, could you describe some of those kinds of experiences that really affected your family's operations?
Well, probably what happened in the 80s as interest rates became absolutely insane and crippling for most people. Yeah. If that same thing happened today with everyone sort of on the edge of their borrowing of capacity, a 2% increase in interest rate will probably kill off 15 or 20% of the people that can actually afford to make their mortgage. In the times when you saw 18 to 24% on your bank loans, bankers were ruthless. They would come in and get your real estate out from under you. I don't know if that was their objective, but we had diversified from dairy into beef, doing custom feeding for people. Their ability to pay us, and it trickled up and it crippled us to a point where we had to sell the farm, or basically the bank brokered it to another owner. We ended up with the 69 acres that's currently under our control as far as DeMille's farm market goes.
What was the full acreage before that? How much did you have?
I think before that there had to have been 200 plus acres on both sides of the river. We had put in a bridge, leveled off a ton of land, and just made it a really beautiful farm. Unfortunately, the numbers just didn't work, and the patience of the bank had been exhausted. No fault of Dad, because I'm in debt. It makes you sharp. And you sometimes it's just you're powerless against that money if you can't get it, and it's hard to find when you need it.
What was that like for you as a kid in the family? You're not as young as you were when you arrived, but you were still pretty young. What did you see around you in the sort of family circle when this incredible disaster struck?
Well, I think it was a pretty private moment, because it's got to be tough.
Yeah.
And honestly, as a young child, like 16 or 18, that's pretty ignorant of what was going on in my parents' life. We had a pretty free spirit. We were allowed to do anything we wanted outside. We had jobs. We'd work for picking corn from Dad. We'd split up the cash at the end of the year and get my $500, and I was rich for a period of time. And we realized that there was something to this, because we were getting more and more popular. We put up illegal signs on Friday because the highways department wouldn't work weekends. They would take them down and bring them back to us on Monday, which was awesome. And these were we would hand paint these signs, and they were just, it was kind of, I have some of them still, but they were pretty poor signs. But people found us a mile and a half down Silver Creek.
My goodness. Dave, you also, your family went through a similar kind of experience in the 80s, early 80s, when the bottom dropped out of the market and interest rates were incredibly high. What was that like? That was also a really hard time, as I understand it.
Oh, definitely. And it's funny, preparing for today, I did speak with my father yesterday, and he mentioned that, yes, things were, going good in the mid to late 70s. Mm-hmm. And then with the all of a sudden, you couldn't get the price for your hogs. He said the government did try to subsidy that price and get you at least close to the market you needed to survive. But he said even then you just couldn't. And as Brad mentioned, I remember the day when we would have only been about 12 years old. But I remember the day and where we're living when Mom and Dad said, by the way, next month we're moving off the farm. And life changed drastically.
So what happened? What were some of those drastic changes that you had to go through?
We didn't live in a particularly huge house or anything, but it was a very comfortable house for all seven of us. And I remember moving into a house that was probably built in the 30s. That was my three brothers and I lived in a room, and my two sisters lived in a room, and my parents lived in a room, and there was one small family room. And of course, the bottom end of it is that there was no money. We shopped, we bartered with local farmers, and us kids all went and found jobs, which was probably a good thing. If we wanted a bike or something like that, you went and found some job. I remember picking asparagus for the next door neighbor just out of a bucket and leaning over. Everybody in Armstrong's had their turn at picking asparagus. And, so of course the horses are gone. The excitement of having 80 acres to roam around on are gone. And of course just the upheaval in the household with the change. Yeah. It's well remembered. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. It's a hardship that changes one's perspective on the world. You realize that the bottom can drop out of things.
Mm-hmm.
David, did your family business, how did it respond or experience that time in the early 80s when there was so much hardship for farmers? Obviously you would see them around you.
Well, the thing is that with the Askew business, it was fairly diversified. We had We had the abattoir, the meat plant, the wholesale meat department, the grocery business, and that business was always rather precarious. I know that the business made wages, but from 1929 until 1965, it didn't make a profit. I remember my father saying he couldn't take depreciation on the equipment and show it on his financial statements, or he would be showing a loss. And so we never had a lot of money to spare. And I think this is where I developed my feeling about people who didn't shop at Askew's, because it affected the size of my Christmas present, whether your family shopped at Askew's or not.
Did you advertise in the newspaper for your Christmas present stipend? Probably not.
And it was similar to what Dave was saying. I mean, well, we did get the odd bicycle or something. If we were going to get it, it would be at Christmas. So, you know, Christmas was always a big event. But there wasn't a lot of extra cash around. And when my father expanded the meat plant or something, he would have to take out a loan. And so, you know, money was not, there wasn't really a lot of money around.
It seems like lean times, people don't always remember that lean times have been part of life in this very halcyon part of the world. It's very beautiful. It's got the four seasons. People want to live here. But that doesn't always mean that the economic circumstances that people face are supportive or easy. Now, Brad,
I had a meeting in Salmon Arm about business, and people were talking about, you know, starting a business here and what it was like and so on. And I said, well, you can do well in business in Salmon Arm. It just takes three generations.
Well, we have multiple generations represented by the current generation on this show today. We spoke about some of the trials and tribulations in the early 80s. Each of you had some different parts of your life take over at this point. Brad, you in your late teens, early 20s, wandered off back to the sunny lands of California. What was that like?
Well, after high school, I spent a mechanic apprentice at Honda for a bit and Robin Hood Toyota. Ended up thinking that wasn't my thing I wanted to do. I probably had a little bit more rambunctious personality trying to get out. So I built a car, a little Volkswagen that I did in the garage at night, and then I packed it up with everything I owned. My brother had had a serious car accident that previous year, and he was just getting out of the woods as far as that. He had a broken back and horrible injuries right at the mouth of our driveway. Hit a semi head on, and at that point I was like, I'm going to go out and do what I want to do. And when did I ever? I left, and Dad encouraged me because, you know, he knew that I wasn't university bound. I was more of a practical person, getting the life skills on the ground and developing that. I went to Chico, California, which was my sister had habitated for a little while. Then we ended up in Santa Barbara. Crazy advantage and so lucky, and was able to eke my living out as a waiter. I remember my first job at a Carol's restaurant. It was very similar to like a Denny's style. I had the bar shift. So at 2 o'clock, the guys would come out, all the drunk guys would come out of the bars with their new girlfriends and whatnot, and they were hungry. And all I could do was that changed my career, actually, if I could say that. I was so in the weeds. I had so many tables and so many orders to get up. I just threw my tablet on his table and said, I'll be back to you. Don't let me forget about you. And then he offered me a job the next day at his big restaurant out in Summerlin, California. And that just took me to places that not only could I sell stuff every day, but my personality developed to what I could attest to a lot of success. People are salesmen. They're also mechanics in life. It's odd to get a combination of the two of those. The guy can take your order at a restaurant and mess everything up on the way out, or he can take your order and do an amazing job delivering to you that same product that you promised. So a salesman and a mechanic together is, I think, what makes this retail successful, because there's both the mechanics and all that going on.
Brad, let me ask you a question. To be a successful farmer, you have to be a salesman and you have to be a mechanic. Is that fair to say? You can't work in that kind of line of work without having the practical skills and a certain vision and a certain image of what you're trying to present to the world.
Well, like any good farmer's got a pile of junk in the back. But I guarantee you, I can find that fan motor if I need one for one of my display cases, and I know how to get it out. My electrician reminds me constantly that I'm not an electrician. And all these things, that we have old equipment. This stuff runs 24/7 every day of the year, and we expect it to perform. And we're so surprised when it stops working. But if you were to call the tech every time something happens, you will not be in business.
I'm chuckling here. My father-in-law was a farmer, a dairy farmer in Langley, and he had a collection of the things that you'll need one day, but you don't know which day it's going to be. David, you moved away from Salmon Arm. You branched off into the world of studies. You went to U of T. What was that like, leaving the home that you've been born and raised in and heading off into the beyond?
Well, I when I left Salmon Arm, I remember because I went to the guidance counselor trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And he suggested taking a year of general studies so I could get a better idea of what the options were. And I thought that was ridiculous, wasting a year of my life trying to figure out something. Of course, instead of that, I probably spent 10 or 12 years wandering around trying to figure things out.
Wisdom of the very young, David, the wisdom of the very young.
I ended up staying in an army barracks down on the side of the ocean there at UBC, and my father came to pick me up, and he felt right at home because he'd been, in army barracks himself during World War II. And I found it kind of difficult, that's for sure. The program was daunting and took a lot of work. And I don't remember, having a lot of time to really horse around and enjoy myself. It was a bit of a grind, really. But then I did get summer jobs up in the Peace River and so on.
You worked for the Forest Service up there.
I did. Yeah, working on the surveying the boundaries of the Williston Lake up on the Peace there. So, although the program itself maybe didn't suit me that well, the opportunities I got as a result of it were pretty interesting.
Were you starting to form some of your ideas about the world and about yourself and of course, the family business indirectly? Because you were receiving, as I recall, you told me, you were receiving some of the financial statements on a regular basis from the store's operations when you were away.
Well, the thing is that I was always like family gatherings. All of my uncles and aunts had worked at, Askew's. It was Salmon Arm Meat and Produce back then. And so the talk was generally around what was going on with the business. So I was always really intensely interested in it from an early age. I worked there. I was the ice man chipping out 25-pound blocks of ice for campers. So on back in the day when everybody bought a tent and went off camping and they needed ice to keep their, to keep their hot dogs, their wieners and hamburger cool. Mm. And I enjoyed all that. I remember there was a wife of a doctor, Dr. Beach, Mrs. Beach, and she said, "I don't believe in kids working during the summer." And I thought, gee, that sounds ridiculous. But, I enjoyed all that. I really did.
That's when food happens in the summer. I think somebody in your life told you that you were obsessed about Askew's. Would it be fair to say that it was always there in the background, your connection to the family business?
Yeah, I was always really interested in it. Talked to my father long distance when I was working for DuPont in Toronto. At that time, the telephone rates went down at midnight, so you could phone from there after midnight. It would be 9 o'clock here in Salmon Arm, and you could talk, and it didn't really cost you very much. So I did spend a lot of time talking to him about how things were going and what was up and all that sort of thing. So as I say, and you mentioned the financial statements, and I always paid attention. So when I ended up coming back here, it might have looked like I dropped out of nowhere, but actually, you know, I had been thinking about the business all my life.
Dave, you pursued each of you today has pursued a different course. Your course was to stay here and start working, as it turns out, early on in your working life with Askews in a variety of different ways.
Yes, as I mentioned, I think I started in 1983 when I was 14 or 15 years old, acquired a horrible habit of fast cars, and so I had to keep working to supply my habit. That's kind of just a joke, of course. But Askews did pay.
I don't know. It's a serious addiction, Dave. It's a serious addiction.
Askews did pay well at the time, and it worked out quite well for me. Is when I hit 18, you know, you moved in with a couple of buddies, and you know, into your own place, and started full time right after school, and. I think it was probably in my early 20s, I started on the night crew, working 3 a.m, and I quite enjoyed it. And that's when you got the experience of ordering the shelves after you've stocked it in the morning. So that got you into that next level of working in the store, not just, you know, coming in, what are we doing today? Oh, go put that stock out and, you know, bagging groceries. So it was kind of the next level working in that night crew. I had the opportunity to take part in the ordering and the bookings. And then I think I got married around 24 years old and had to grow up real fast and, you know, tried to take on more responsibilities with the company. And I was very fortunate that those opportunities were there to keep growing with Askews Foods. And I've been there ever since.
Now, you're off in California, the states and various parts of the states, but California in particular, Brad. But you came back. You came back. And I think it had something to do with a certain young woman that you met. How did that go?
Well, it was
That's called a leading question, Brad.
I got you. I know. I was be careful not to step in too deep here. Going to California was a great place to be in the summertime because it was perpetually summer, but unaffordable long term. It was just so expensive. Everything I made to work, I worked to live and lived to work. And I decided one day to go to Aspen, Colorado for basically three years. I just picked up my car and I left, kind of like the modern nomad, I guess. And then I was getting kind of bored of the whole thing with, at the end of the season in Colorado, there was a big gap in the end of the year to where summer started because summer was pretty abbreviated way up in the Rockies. So I came back one summer and honestly, I loved what I was doing outside, doing crop management, working the ground, being part of the retail, delivering corn, probably to Askews because we share a lot of the same clients. And one of our longest term clients has been Askews Foods. It's a very good relationship. I really liked what we did. So I had left, I'd worked through the fall and I went back to Aspen that last year and then moved back permanently. I met Kelly. She was on a baseball team and oh, I said, I like that girl. And my buddy Brad Shirley, he's the fire chief. He goes, we'll go find her. And here we are up in Five Corners up in Salmon Arm. We're looking for her address. Like seriously, we'd been thrown in jail these days.
Stalking. You were stalking her.
Yeah. Well, light stalking.
Yes, light stalking. Stalking. Affectionate stalking.
And at that point, then the rest is really history, and it's worked out quite well. We have two great kids.
What position did she play in the baseball team?
She was the pitcher.
Aha. Uh-huh. You went for the high class, the star.
Yeah. Yeah, and I remember Jim Grebe hit a line drive and hit her in the front of the thigh, and she fell onto the mound, and I ran out. I think I ran out. This is the way I remember it. So, and then it was fun, and from then on, it was just it was fun. So,
and so what year did you move back to Salmon Arm?
Oh gosh, that was a test year. I think it was 1993.
Okay.
So I was gone for about 10 years.
And you became pretty much involved back in the operation of the farm and the market?
Well, it was always coming, like David, dropping in from nowhere. seemingly unexpected. Isn't that convenient, right? That's the perception from a lot of ways. I worked hard to get back there to get into position of acceptance through my dad and his wife, because my mom and dad had divorced. And it was a struggle. Family business is hard.
So
it's
every day. You came back with some new ideas from your experiences, you know, spreading your wings, doing various things that were not specifically farm work, but which involved developing skills that would become useful in the farm setting, the, you know, being able to sell ideas as much as that. But your dad and you came from different generations, so there was an adaptation process that went on between you, which was a challenge for both of you.
You know, I think if you can leave Salmon Arm and get a better perspective of what you left, it gives you a heightened awareness of how nice this place is. A lot of times the 80s didn't come to Salmon Arm until 1993. Because it was really delayed back then, trends and fashions and things. I could go to California or Aspen, come back here, and I wouldn't see that same thing on the shelf for 2 years. A lot of the reason why is that Canada wasn't a very big market for things, especially with French labeling, metric, and all that. Someone's going to have access to, let's say, 30 million people. And out of that, they're going to have 10% of that market. They're not going to do all those semantics to get a product on our shelves. And this is why we're denied a lot of those things. But I could bring them back and have ideas to where it was going to go. Not like I was a genius on it, but I was aware.
Sure. David, you went away in a different manner. You went to school. You worked as a counselor at the university, U of T. And you also became involved with union activities. And you described it to me once as helping people adjust to the system that they lived in and worked in, but also trying to change the system that they worked in. That was an interesting thing for you, was it not?
Yes, well, I had left Salmon Arm with the woman who became my wife, and we went to France. We came back. We had both lived in Toronto. As a matter of fact, unknown to either of us, we had at one point lived across the street from each other in Toronto, but we didn't meet until we ended up both here in Salmon Arm. Anyway,
must have been a very wide street.
Well, there was a lot of people in Toronto, no matter where you were, and this was right in the heart of downtown Toronto. But I got involved. I thought it maybe I wanted to be a social worker or a counselor or something like that instead of an engineer. So eventually ended up applying for a job. I saw this ad in the newspaper. We had gone to France and we went back to Toronto, and I saw this ad in the newspaper. They wanted a career counselor, and they said that they wanted someone with a science or engineering background in counseling. And I thought, well, how many of those are there around? And as I had been an engineer and done some volunteer work and so on with a view to becoming more of a social worker type, I looked into what kind of training I could get for counseling, and it turned out the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education had a program specifically for people who were working in a field related to education, like career counseling, but who didn't have the qualifications. So I actually ended up getting the job and getting into that program. So that's kind of got my life in Toronto established.
And that made you start thinking about justice issues, nexus.
Well, what happened was that U of T had many, many science-oriented people who were working in university laboratories where professors get grants and then they hire people to run there and work in their labs. And what was happening was that a professor would have someone working for them for 10 years or so, and then their niece or nephew would graduate, and when the grant came up, they said, well, I'm going to hire my niece and I don't need you anymore. So these people would come to me and say, well, I'm having to look for something different as a career because of this. And I thought, this is an injustice and I'm going to see if I can do something about it. So I looked around and I found out that there were some people endeavoring to form a trade union at U of T, and I got involved with them.
And then there, some time went by. You were involved with the BC Energy Council and some other kinds of work, both in the Lower Mainland and up here. But eventually you came back here, and at the time of your father's death, that's when you became directly involved with the story.
True.
And
that's
I think I want to fast forward, because you're all back in Salmon Arm. Brad's come back from California. David's come back from Toronto. And all along, Dave has been quietly working his way up the ladder in the food retail business, doing the thing that probably all of us, if we were organized in our lives, we would have done something like that. But thank heaven, sometimes we're not organized. So there's the three of you back in Salmon Arm, and you're seeing a very different scene from 30, 40 years ago. I'd like each of you to just describe what you see in the food scene here, both its strengths and weaknesses, compared to what it was like 30 or 40 years ago. So, Dave, you stayed here and lived through all that directly. What changes do you see that are important? As we come to the end of our show, we want to kind of sum this up. What do you see, David? Dave?
Right now, I think, to kind of summarize it, Warren, I'm seeing our customers and people in general, they're telling us what they want us to have in our stores, whereas as maybe back in the 80s, we let them know what we had. But right now they're telling us what they want, whether it's a BC product, a Canadian product, a local product, an organic product, a natural product. They're wanting variety depending on what they feel they should be consuming, and they're letting us know about it. And I spoke with the produce managers this morning, just an example, and one of our store managers who does a lot of our marketing. And I said, you know, as compared to 15 years ago, are we losing those local producers and suppliers? And they actually said no, there is more. There is more where we can attain that. When someone is asking for something, we do have more local or BC or organic options to choose from as to before. Sorry, go ahead.
So people would probably agree that there's been a fairly massive amalgamation in the food world. I was looking up the statistics for Pattison Food Group, Jimmy Pattison's food group, and his overall business empire has something like 48,000 people as of 2020, 48,000 employees, and earnings of $10.9 billion, operating on every continent in the world. And yet what you're seeing and describing is a resurgence of ordinary people getting interested in the quality of the food that they buy and the diversity of the food they seek out. Is that fair to say?
I would say yes, definitely. You look at the larger companies such as Kraft, they're buying up those smaller companies that may have started out as a local company, whether it be in a province or in a community. And so then all of a sudden they become a big numbered company, and we actually don't get the service we require from them anymore. For instance, they might not be sending sales representatives round and round to the stores and looking for your business. So we do have options. If you're not going to help us, maybe we'll turn to some of our local suppliers to fill that gap. And we have the customers and the public are wanting that that option.
Brad, you've really made that a cornerstone of your business operation and your market. 150 local producers giving you their produce to sell. That's pretty much doing what Dave has described in a very direct way.
Yeah, we looked at the farmers markets. This is not a negative, but we looked at it as a challenge to our bottom line, because we were kind of in a similar business. except for we were in it every single day with fixed assets and actually overhead. Not that they don't, but we looked at it and said, well, how are we going to compete with this? And it's, well, you can't really. And so we decided to bring most of these folks in the fold, approach them to supply us with product 7 days a week. And we've got currently over 150 now, because we've just picked up another 20 contracts for this summer. Just local people that maybe they have a little patch of ground and behind their 70s box home in their little lots in San Marino, and they're growing pickles or cucumbers or dill or basil for us. And those things are really fun because they get their hands dirty. They're making a few bucks. We pay them fairly. We have to make some margin on it too, because we have costs. But we're finding that we're not running out of that lettuce that someone raced to the farmer's market to get at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning, and it's gone by 10:30. The bread that's being produced by the Little Red Hen is available as a default setting, instead of just having to be lucky to get it, because we're busy in this life, and a lot of times you just can't go on a Tuesday or Friday or Saturday morning. And reducing your carbon footprint from a centralized distribution is kind of what we make sense of it. And we feel that we're just getting started. We're very excited about our relationships with these farmers. A lot of the bigger stores, and I mentioned this yesterday, will have a picture of the guy that they bought the Long English from on their wall. Well, that's the only time he was there. If you want to meet our guys, go to the back loading dock and meet them.
Yes, it's a very immediate relationship. And I think my sense is that it's a trend. You talked about it, Dave. You're amplifying it, Brad, that there's a trend towards, in a way, dealing with some of the issues we're all going to have to deal with, like climate change and loss of biodiversity. We're going to have to deal with them by maybe becoming more integrated as a local, regional food system. David, you've thought about these matters quite a bit, and obviously you have a few things to say about them in terms of us developing a new way of doing things. Do you want to say a few words just in closing out now?
Well, our structure is a bit different than a typical sort of large supermarket chain, whereby we have tried to retain the expertise in the stores rather than centralizing everything in head office. So our department managers, store managers at the local level, like Armstrong, Sycamore, Salmon Arm, can buy locally, and they have the knowledge and the skills to do that. So we are able to access local supply. And as Dave said, for example, in some areas like strawberries and so on, which are really difficult to sell in supermarkets, we're starting to get, you know, different varieties of strawberries grown in Salmon Arm. They might not be quite as tasty as the ones that you get when you just get them in the picked in the morning and you get them in the morning, but a supermarket isn't really set up that way. So if you can get a strawberry that's not, you know, that's somewhere in between, that's grown in Salmon Arm, we can sell it in our supermarkets. And there's more and more of that kind of thing happening. At the same time, you have this sort of countervailing thing of the bigger getting bigger and swallowing up. Choices has been bought by the Pattison Group.
Indeed.
So that kind of consolidation is threatening to, because we're still really dependent. We still, over 50% of our sales are in the grocery department, in the grocery aisles. We're still dependent on those suppliers to, you know, make those products available to us.
I have a feeling, hearing the three of you talk about the development of food as a sector in this area, and Brad, you've talked about that. Dave, you've outlined the changes you've seen, and David, you've presented this kind of vision of the Goliath sort of poised out there, but something special being able to be done in this region by these kinds of relationships you're building, and the not just the relationships with your customers, but relations within your own organizations, the way you run your food market, Brad, and the way you run your store, David, is, I think, something that's a new wave coming forward and maybe making us a little more resilient. We're going to come to an end now. You're going to hear these three guests today, David Askew, Brad DeMille, and Dave Wallace, next week on Food Conversations, where we're going to have a follow-up program exploring where we can go in the situation of producing food in the Shuswap and how to make it more resilient and enhance food sovereignty. Thank you very much to my three guests, David, Brad, and Dave. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.